Welcome to Technology Tangents. We get leaders together to discuss the important tech of today and the implications for tomorrow. Our discussions are fun, lighthearted, and frankly opinionated, but hopefully gives you a sense of what matters, what to pay attention to, and what to ignore. Joining me, as always, is Jason Goth. Welcome, Jason.
Hey, Vincent. Happy Monday. I usually say happy Friday, but it's Monday today.
It is Monday today, and I'll tell why in just 1 second. But before I do, Kevin, glad to have you as well.
Thank you, Vincent. Glad to be here again.
And the reason it's Monday today is we actually have some pretty cool guests with us today. The first is Jeremiah Stone. Welcome, Jeremiah.
Thank you, Vincent. Excited to be here.
We're excited to have you. And for those who don't know Jeremiah, Jeremiah Stone is actually the CTO of SnapLogic, where he leads product strategy and is responsible for guiding the development and future direction of SnapLogic's platform. Jeremiah is an experienced builder of advanced technology, products that leverage the full power of AI to solve real business problems. And prior to SnapLogic, Jeremiah was the CTO at a healthcare startup called OnTrack. And before that, he had senior leadership roles at both GE and SAP. And he is currently finishing up a master's program at Berkeley and graduated at the University of Colorado's mathematics program, which is all very exciting. And incidentally, a good friend of mine where we worked together at GE, super smart guy, excited for you guys to have a chance to listen to him. So welcome again, Jeremiah.
It's great to be here. I'm a longtime listener, first-time caller, and excited to dig in on the hot takes that Jason has had in some previous podcasts. So this is going to be fun.
This will be fun. Just so we don't gang up on Jeremiah today, he actually brought Greg Benson, the chief scientist at SnapLogic, who leads forward-looking research and innovation projects. He's also a professor of computer science at the University of San Francisco. Greg's published several papers in the field of operating systems, distributed systems, and programming languages. He's one of the original architects of SnapLogic's programming model and cloud platform. And Greg leads the machine learning research work that also resulted in SnapLogic's Iris AI. Welcome, Greg.
Hey, great to be here, Vincent. Also a longtime listener, and really, it's a pleasure to be able to join you guys.
Well, we're excited to have both of you today. So back to Jeremiah's point here, he alluded to it, but I want to pick up on a topic we had on a previous podcast, actually a couple. The first is around low-code, no-code environments. Again, we had Cody back on this episode where we discussed some of the pros, cons, and where we thought the evolution of that going. The second topic I want to talk a little bit about is around AI and all of the exciting things happening with ChatGPT, of course, and other large language models. And the third is really around this idea that, in fact, when organizations want to optimize, what are they optimizing around? On a previous one, we had Mike Nygaard on to talk about the optimization around developer experience. And when you look at all three of those side by side, I think they were all really fascinating and exciting topics, but really the intersection is today's tech conversation starter. And that intersection to me looks a lot like what I'll call higher abstraction tooling. And actually that was a term that I learned from you, Jeremiah. So maybe you can just kick us off by explaining what is higher abstraction tooling?
Well, if you look at the, past 60 or 70 years of forward progress in using digital technology, that has been a series of ways to collapse the distance between the things we think about and actually working products and systems. And along the way, we've moved from, really hand building these systems. If you've seen The Imitation Game or things like that, and you watch the ages of analog computing, that was really construction of circuits that accomplished specific bespoke tasks. Then we had the programmable computer, but that was still very low level, as we say, or ones and zeros. That moved to a higher abstraction where you have a character representation of the instructions the machine should execute. And that has proceeded apace. And we've had essentially more and more, let's call it natural language-like ways to codify what you want a computing system to accomplish. And I certainly would agree. I think what we're seeing now in the form of model-driven engineering or so-called low-code, no-code platforms, or now what we're seeing with these large-scale generative AI models is, again, the same thing, really trying to collapse that distance between an idea and a functioning system. And so that's what I mean by a higher level of abstraction is you're further away from the actual circuit design or the instruction set that is being executed. And I think that what's really interesting along the way historically is that at every epoch where we've moved to a higher level of abstraction or further away from the ones and zeros, there's this fierce debate. between the ability to get done what you want to accomplish in a performant way versus really speed to achieve your goal. And I think there's a tension, and it's an important tension between those two worlds. But I think what we're experiencing now is, you know, part of the continual evolution that we've seen over the past 60 or 70 years.
Jason, anything to add to that from your perspective?
No, I think that's exactly right. And I like the focus on tension, right? Because there are always trade-offs in these things, right? There's trade-offs between speed of development, as we talked with Mike Nygaard, and, you know, like production visibility or optimization or tuning or, you know, hand tuning things that may need to run, you know, really fast or in some specific context. And so those are just kind of two things that kind of pull against each other.
Well, I think I want to explore that tension a little bit. Like, help me understand when and where should you think about using these higher abstraction tooling, whether that be AI generated, low code environments, IDEs, platforms like SnapLogic, where, when and where?
I can take a pass at that, and it'd be interesting to get Greg's perspective, Jason's as well. I think that what we tend to see, or what I've seen over the course of my work, is that when we're working to create jobs, infrastructure, code, what have you, that trods a known path, that tends to be a good place for a higher abstraction, because the problem space is understood as well as the delivery space. And that allows forgiveness in the tooling so that you can anticipate the need you're trying to solve and then the execution of it. I think that is actually a poor place to put a highly competent, skilled engineer who's capable of using an expressive computing language, because often what you're optimizing for in that case is the quality of the analysis and translating a business problem or a technical design into a functioning system. And I think that those individuals will not necessarily have accumulated the richness of learning in those well-trod paths. And that's really where the, you know, higher abstraction environments can capture, sustain, and encapsulate long-term learning in more well-understood domains, whereas they're not going to necessarily be optimal for a completely new domain in an area that requires a tremendous amount of analysis and work. So that's kind of how I think of it, is level of ambiguity might be the easiest way to go back to it. If you're executing on a task which has a lower level of ambiguity, the task space is understood, the performance requirements are understood, the architecture is understood, I think it's a good place for higher abstraction. If, on the other hand, you're working in a domain with a lot of ambiguity, that's where I think you want more degrees of freedom, which is what an expressive system will allow you to do.
Yeah, I like that. Anything to add there, Greg?
Yeah, I think for me, low code, no code, higher levels of abstraction, the challenges that we faced with this progression is that while I think we've made certain tasks easier to perform, they still are very explicit. Even if we can sort of put up the guardrails and we can, you know, make it so that you can get to an objective. And to be clear here, the objective I'm talking about is programming, right? Meaning that when we talk about tooling and abstraction, we're talking about how humans can encode one way or another a program that will be used and reused with facing different inputs for future use. And I think that's been one of the biggest challenges that we face in going to these higher levels of abstraction, is it's still very explicit. And again, softening things as we will, if you don't dot your I's and cross your T's in the program, whether you do it graphically low code or if you do it in Python, it's not going to work. And I think the exciting thing that we're seeing is obviously bringing in the generalization and being able to be a bit more ambiguous in your intent and then get to something that can work in a variety of situations. So that's definitely something I see exciting moving forward.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. And I think it actually fits with the lens that I usually use in this context, which is really about, I think about it in terms of durable competitive advantage. That is, places where you're going to have something that's truly your competitive advantage here, that's the place that you want to deploy your human resources to have these rather explicit, rather unique solution spaces, which I think is well aligned with what you said, Jeremiah, namely, like, in places where it's well-trod paths, like, you're just not going to be differentiated in that space. It's well understood. People already know how to do that. And so you should take advantage of the fact that other people have already spent their time banging their head against the wall, I guess.
I think that's exactly right. Specific to a business domain, a business opportunity, there is very often room for creativity that cannot stand on the shoulders of others and learning. And I think what is not well understood with a lot of the current hype in the generative AI world is that often in the information worker space, the opportunity space for doing good things is effectively infinite. And we're gated by the time and energy of the individuals who can analyze the problem and try to deliver against that problem. It's not a piecework manufacturing exercise. So automation and productivity allows us to explore the problem space further, to mature our solutions better. And now it becomes very important then to free the individuals who best understand the business problem, who know where to find the innovation, to move as quickly as possible through the well-known areas of the space to then work on the lesser known spaces. And that's where I really see where we focus all of our time is, how do we help you get there faster? How do we help you get to that point of focusing on sustainable competitive advantage and through the necessary mountain of stuff that just has to get done in order to focus on the truly differentiating components of the business?
Yeah, I like that. I'm going to pass that over to you, Erickson, here, which is like in that domain of, in your experience from a business strategies perspective, is the problem today innovation, the problem of innovation, is it really the idea to go do something, or is it the time and capacity to go get it done?
You know, thinking about the frame that you're presenting there for a second, I might shift it a bit. I mean, I think what's intriguing to me is that we've spent the last 20, 25 years really having so many of our employees, the rise of technology, the different ways we do things, and you had all this work and effort that's been done to really trying to do, you know, automate and do repetitive processing that now we're seeing are actually being done in very commonsensical ways. If we go prior to that, so go, you know, say 30, 40 years ago, you had a lot more people in a company that knew their customers, knew what they were doing, they knew their regions, they knew, you know, what you were trying to do, how you innovated really in the business solutions. So if we can envision a world now where the technology components, the basic building blocks of how we do our jobs are more consistent, it's going to be interesting around what is domain knowledge. And I think it's going to be a lot more back to those common principles around what you're doing, what you're trying to accomplish. And it's actually from out of the five of us, the least technical and most business minded, it's actually kind of exciting because it's a chance for us to go back and solve, which I think are more fundamental problems. And to what, why we exist as an organization. I mean, we think about how much time and energy we spend today thinking about what are the technology tools that we need to do? How do we run through data? What real estate do we need? What is our employees? All these different things. So much of our energy within a corporation is not spent on actually doing why we exist, which is to serve our customers, which is to have hopefully offer a competitive good that betters society, however you may define that. And so I'm excited to get back into that. Now, from a business strategy, what's the so what of all that? You know, I think it's going to be interesting to see, you know, how do we train our people? How do we find our individuals? Where do we invest in R&D? You know, going back to your specific question, Vincent, you know, where do we invest that in from a product development perspective? Where is that from a solutioning? And I think that this is why I get excited about the products that within the Snap landscape, to where to hopefully we're making our companies and individuals be able to focus more on what is more interesting and unique to them to create that competitive advantage.
Yeah, I think that's really good. So if one of the benefits is really about the idea that we can empower business users to get to their solutions faster, what are some of the other benefits? And I really am thinking, Jason, of our last episode with Mike, where we were talking about the developer experience. Is this a better developer experience from your standpoint, or what parts of it are better maybe?
Well, I think we want to separate out some of the low code or no code tools from some of the more generative AI type tools, right? I think in those former, and I think I agree with Jeremiah, we really want to free up some of the mundane, well-worn paths from the, you know, developers to go build, you know, more novel things and ambiguous things. I think maybe the AI tools might be a really big help, you know, in that space, but I would say from a developer platform perspective, I would much rather see, you know, developers, you know, who are computer science and that kind of background focused on some of those type problems, ambiguous problems, versus some of the well-worn stuff where I think you can get analysts, you know, well-trained analysts. There's still, and you know, you've heard my rant about this, but there's still a need to understand a logical set of steps to solve a problem, even with those low code tools. But I do think, you know, that can be, you know, trained up in the business analyst team or others to get some of those simple tasks done. And then letting, you know, the developers work on those other problems. I think that may be where AI comes in.
Yeah, I think that's interesting, Jason, which starts to potentially beg the question of what is a developer and what is an analyst? I mean, I think it's possible that they start to come together. We're already seeing this in terms, at least of many of our young employees who wants to be data scientists and want to be really focusing on the insights. Some are interested in the technology and the way that they get to that. Many are just the outcomes. And so I think it'd be interesting if we start to continue to kind of blur that line between the different functions, and you have a lot more technically minded process engineering type folks that are playing more in the core functionalities. And for two of the five of us that are on this call that have a GE background, that's pretty common how that approaches. And you've seen that work in a lot of different companies. But it's a shift from where we've been, let's say, in the last 25, 30 years, where all the best and the brightest have typically pursued a technical product route.
Well, I would say, and I use this analogy a lot, like, let's don't confuse the ability to use a calculator with being an accountant, right? And that, I think, is, you know, one of the mistakes people make. You start thinking about these tools and their ability to make you more productive, right? But you still need to have, if you're the accountant, you still need to have a lot of core fundamental understanding as a developer around what that tool is doing and what the best strategies are. You can say, go write code to do X, right? But you still need to know how to, like, integrate that code. Like, why do I get the code to do X, right? You know, it's like putting, you know, adding two numbers. You don't just add any two random numbers on a calculator. You got to know which columns from the spreadsheet to do it on. And so I do think there is still going to be a distinction in terms of, like, hey, we just need to get data from this system to that system, and that's a well-worn path, and there are great tools to do that, versus I'm creating something new and I need to think through, like, what are the actual problems that are going to arise by doing this? And the fact that a tool can make, you know, the creation of that go faster, it's, you know, it's no different to me than, like, typing on an actual typewriter, which I actually learned to type on an IBM Selectric typewriter, and having to go back and white stuff out versus doing a word processor. I think that's the analogy I use for a lot of those AI tools, but what the thought that goes into it is still going to be required.
But I hear what you're saying, Jason, but I do want to push back a little bit. I think if I think about data science as a proxy for developers in general, and I realize it's a subset, to be very clear, I think that the question I'd have for you is, doesn't actually that become easier? Meaning, like, the people who understand the problem the best probably sit within the business today. And the current blocker for them to solve the problem is the development or the sort of knowledge of how to actually code in these expressive languages. So if you're able to empower them with some tool that lets them accomplish at least the simple tasks or the tasks that are sort of well-trodden paths, I think we're going to stuck on that the rest of the episode. I like that a lot. If we let them focus on those, they'll actually get to a better answer quicker. But to validate that, I want to pass it over to you guys on the SnapLogic side. Have you seen that? Have you not seen that? I mean, your customers, you're the core customers, exactly the people we're talking about. What have you seen happen?
I am reminded continually by our customers that analysis, critical thinking, problem decomposition, design is not gifted to people because they know how to write C or C++. And I think that is a very important distinction to make. And it's, I think, almost an educational question, because one of the things that I think we're seeing more broadly within just the species, like people living in modern technological societies, by the time someone graduates from high school, even, never mind university, their exposure to complex technology is tremendous. My son, I've got a 12-year-old son. He likes playing, you know, on PlayStation, other platforms, and to watch him configure his playing environment It's more complex than an ERP system. It's amazing. The level of configurability, mixing ambient audio levels, the refresh rates, those sorts of things. And so I think what we see often is the most gifted and productive users in our user base do not have technical backgrounds. They do, however, have deep domain knowledge of their businesses. And that's kind of the success stories we love, is where somebody who had an understanding of their business, how to please their customers and get things into production, could do so without the burden of having to learn how to code, how to build a build file, how to structure their technical environment. If you think about, you really take a step back, what provocative question is, what percentage of the burden and gateway to development tooling is actually environmental? And how much of it is focused on solving the actual problem? And that's really where we like to focus. And, you know, if I were to encourage somebody who's evaluating this space, one very important question is, do the tools you're looking at, are they so-called Turing complete? Can you solve any potential technical problem with them? And if so, are they, you know, a good fit for the good thinkers in your organization, people who can do good problem decomposition, understand your business and understand what you want to achieve? In that case, you may have an acceleration potential within your midst that you're not even aware of. And I just echo Kevin's comment from earlier. I think it's tremendously exciting because we've gotten to a point now where we've sort of gotten out of the arcane priesthood of coding to the point where a good thinking person capable of that analysis can actually move from thought stuff to reality on their own without having to go, you know, endure the pain I went through as an engineer of many years of you know, building these systems. So I think it's tremendously exciting. I do think there are systems out there that purport to be able to do this that are incredibly constraining. You can't get hard things done. And that is absolutely a reality, and that is a true thing. I don't know. I'd ask Greg, though. I mean, how do you see the educational environment evolving to support people who are capable of complex problem decomposition and solving problems without having to go learn how to hack assembly code and stuff first?
Well, I'll get to that specific point. But one thing I wanted to riff on was this notion of amplifying somebody's domain knowledge and allowing them to be productive and, you know, creators of processes and whatnot. And, you know, at SnapLogic, one thing that, and I've been here a while now, that we struggle with is this notion of solutions versus a flexible platform. And we've always leaned on trying to come up with abstractions and mechanisms to help you bring your thinking and your domain and your processes to the platform rather than trying to force a constraint on you, which is, I think, what's made us successful. Now, that introduces challenges, right? So as a flexible low-code platform, then now you know, the world is your oyster and you have to, you know, it confronts you with lots of flexibility. And kind of circling back on your point, and one thing that I haven't heard in the much in the general conversation around generative AI is, I tell my students, you're going to spend 80 to 90% of your time debugging. Okay. So, and I, you know, debugging isn't a punishment. It's part of the problem solving process, right? And it's something that you engage and enjoy. And it's interesting, all this generative AI stuff is, you know, where does debugging fit in that picture? Yeah, it can construct a Python program for you, or, you know, we are helping our customers construct our pipelines for them, but you're still going to end up fine tuning that to a specific task, and things aren't going to always go well. I can tell you, I've had mixed results with the LLMs that are out there. We actually did an exercise, kind of interesting, where we had it generate some Java code, and we wanted to see how far we could push it. It didn't generate code that can compile, so then we fed all of the Maven and Java compiler messages back into the prompt, and we went back and forth probably 6 or 7 times, and we never got resolution. So I think that's another part of this conversation, is not just the assistance in creating something that is a program, but where does this evolve in where the human, and I believe the real, you know, intellectual intersection is the domain knowledge plus this
ability to reason about what you're observing and then making changes to change the course of this program to achieve what you want to do.
Yeah. And, you know, I would agree with everything that Jeremiah and Greg just said. However, what I'm kind of getting to is what the evolution of that becomes to is programming, right? Because you say, let me give you just a quick example. You say, well, I'm going to create some solution to do multi-arm bandit testing on my web pages, you know, images I display on my web page. And so I say, create a web page that shows multiple things, right? And out of this list. Well, where does that list come from? Well, I got to go create a thing that lets me create a list. And, you know, you have to work down that. Now you've got those. You have these debugging problems. It's not right. I've got to figure that out. It doesn't work quite as fast as I want, but now it finally works. Okay, great. Now I get the data back in. Bring, you know, build something to collect the data, right? Build something to build a, you know, whatever, you know, I'm not a statistician, but like whatever statisticians, like at some point you go to really having to dictate the underlying thought processes under a system. And that is what programming is. Right now, today we've got the problem that it requires the understanding some weird, bizarre language syntax. Okay, well, we can remove that, but it doesn't change the fundamental problem of thinking, you know, thinking through. And that, and so that's why I still feel like there's benefit in having kind of that background in development, even with these tools. They're going to make you much more productive and much faster. I'm not saying we won't use them, but I do think that the idea that, like, well, we're going to have business domain experts with no math, programming, structured analysis kind of background is really not feasible. Now, maybe what those programs turn into, and I don't know, Greg, I'd love to get your thought on this, is maybe those disciplines move into more of like the business school and those type of things.
Yeah, I wonder, and I'll give it back to you, Jeremy, because I think that you raise a good point here, which is that question of how much is really environmental versus how much is problem solving. And if I heard you right, I think what you're saying is really most of the programming, quote unquote, skill set is on that environmental side. And that the business research, the domain knowledge is what's required to solve the problem solving, at least conceptually. Is that right? Did I decouple that correctly or did I get it backwards? Again, like my point here is that if you had some environment where you could stand up a multi-arm bandit with a click of a button, you said, I want to run a multi-arm bandit. The domain expertise of what is it that I'm really trying to test, what hypothesis I'm trying to validate or invalidate here, is the problem solving side of that, setting it up correctly, figuring out which users are going to see which version, et cetera, et cetera. It's not so much like, did I get the statistical test correct?
Right. But as a statistician, you know that a thing called a multi-arm bandit exists.
Okay. Yep.
Right.
I do.
As a business, you know, school graduate, you may not.
I disagree.
Okay, I'm just saying.
Well, it's the resident MBA of the group.
Yeah. I'm just thinking there are a lot of things that you know we all as professional engineers and developers and consultants take for granted that from an analysis perspective that I don't think, you know, exist in general domain expertise yet.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, Jason. I think one of the things we're nibbling at here is really around critical thinking skills across different domains, whether that be within technology, how you work through that, whether it be in other functions of a business, whether it be math, stats, business, you know. And I think what's really intriguing to me is really around how do we continue to see, well, where does that come from? Where does that go reside from that? What educational experiences do you have to rip through that? What do we learn and how do we teach our employees to think about that? You know, and because I think that that's really what we're trying to get to. Then how also is that unique to a specific company and its domain? We have a lot of, you know, short termism in terms of people, you know, going to companies and leaving. How does that play out? Particularly if the domain knowledge that we're really trading now is not no longer technical, how we do something, but it's actually very specific to what that organization or what they want to exist. And so it's going to be interesting because I think we'll start to see some of the, some of the power that's been really more at the employee level over the last couple of years for several reasons, not just technology. You're going to potentially shift back to the organization in terms of where the real value of what that person has is going to be based on the domain and specific knowledge that you gain from that.
Yeah. And it raises a good question. I want to ask you, Greg, to comes on a point you made, which is really this debugging is not a punishment. I liked that, by the way. It's part of the problem solving process. I think that's really insightful. One of the questions I have for you though is that, you know, if you gave me some issue, some bug in a language that I've never seen before, I don't really know, it's not particularly helpful to me, even though I know other languages, other programming. How do you learn? How do you make sense of that? Said differently, like, how do you learn how to make sense of these messages if we're taking all of the really well-trodden paths, all these really simple things out of the educational, and I mean educational meaning on-the-job training, really, educational path? Like, I'm not exposed to the easy stuff where it's a very simple bug. Like, how do you learn that, develop that muscle?
That's exactly what I'm getting to, by the way, in my piece. So I'd love to hear Greg's answer to that.
Yeah, you know, this is, it goes to that critical thinking point. You probably heard these tropes, right? The becoming a good developer, which again is in my mind, a good problem solver, given the context that they're working in, meaning yes, creation, but largely observation and then altering, and call that process debugging, call it, you know, incremental development. That's a, it's, you know, we've struggled to pinpoint it, right? In computers, it's really fascinating, right? Computer science and computer programming has not gone the path that I thought it would 30 years ago. If you look at mechanical engineering or electrical engineering, civil engineering, I mean, we can build these structures, we can build these bridges, and they can stand, you know, largely the test of time, and they're based on fundamental practices and principles and mathematics, right? We don't seem to have those in the same form in computer science. I honestly thought 30 years ago, so this is my 25th year as a professor, I thought, oh yeah, we would have the same type of licensing and certifications and recertifications that, say, a civil or mechanical engineer needs to attain. We don't have that, right? And that's a whole nother podcast probably, but again, I come back with my students is the more situations that you experience, your brain is cataloging. And it's interesting. If you look at what large language models are trained on, they're not trained on experiences, right? They're trained on artifacts that are encoded in some digital form, right? Whereas, you know, the human computer scientist is cataloging all of these dynamic experiences that they can draw on to come to then when they encounter a new problem, they can, you know, draw on that experience. Now, going to your point, this idea of error messages and how to generalize and, you know, how can we lift the user to work in those in an environment. And I'll tell you, like, I'm learning Rust, and Rust has got its own set of Rust, the programming language. It's got its own set of conventions and syntax, which is a meld of a lot of previous stuff. But then it's also got its own error messages that pertain to that, those semantics. And it's challenging. If models can help relate what you observe in a new environment, a new programming environment, and then allow you to quickly relate it to your past experiences, then maybe it could unblock you in some way.
Yeah, that's super interesting. Anything to add there, Jeremiah?
I think Greg makes a very interesting comparison to engineering disciplines. We've been learning how to do civil engineering for well over 2,000 years. We've been learning to do software engineering for 70 years, 80 years.
Jason, you were on day one?
No.
We were still using Whiteout when Jason started.
It's, we are... I think sometimes we get overly precious and full of ourselves in our industry. We are definitely still in the mud and sticks phase of doing this. And, you know, we are part of simultaneously the most complex and least well understood engineering domain, I think, that Homo sapiens has created. And I think when we start talking about these tools of higher abstraction, sometimes I wonder, are we really starting to create or invent, you know, a hammer or a screwdriver, et cetera? And to Jason's point, does being able to swing a hammer make you a framer? Absolutely not. And if you watch somebody actually frame out a building, it is there's an art and a science to that, and understanding the complexity of the calculus and the shearing load involvements. Even using a framing square is something that requires a lot of training and understanding of pretty fundamental mathematics. But I also think that there is a spectrum of problems, and there are problems that require having that level of depth, knowledge, and experience, and there are problems that don't require that. And I think that so far, our field has been very inaccessible to people who can address a spectrum of those problems with business knowledge and just enough technical support that aren't going to get them into the deep end of having to design their storage modalities or their stochastic problem for a multi-armed bandit problem. I mean, I think that's pretty far to one side of the technical spectrum. If I want to connect my marketing system with my sales system and I understand the pieces of information that should be synchronized, I don't think that should require a computer science degree.
Yeah, that I love that example of Framer. You know, okay, maybe some of these tools are automatic nail guns and you know, other things. And I think it's a great example, and I agree wholeheartedly with that. I think those problems that are very, I connect my marketing system to my sales system or what, my forecasting system, whatever. That is the domain where I think a lot of these tools can be immediately deployed and the analyst can go do them. I think the things where we're creating things that are net new, maybe on devices that are net new, you know, for all the incredibleness of these models are that, you know, they're not trained on anything past 2021. So if, you know, let's put this back and let's assume that OpenAI had built this model and it was impressive as it is in 2005, right? Trained through 2005 and 2006, the iPhone launches. And the first thing I say is like, hey, create me an app for the iPhone. It doesn't even know that the iPhone exists. So someone's going to have to create that to even train a model to be able to be used. And so I still think that there's these two different paths, things that are entirely net new that require a lot of creative thinking. And again, I still think that a lot of the tools will help remove some of that boilerplate environmental stuff that is always a pain for developers, absolutely, versus things that are, I just know, what, you know, well-trodden paths, as Jeremiah said.
Jason, I agree with that. Do you see it as an accelerated virtuous cycle where now, you know, the interaction between the model and the creator would be able to get us to the iPhone more quickly or to the next, you know, the next iPhone-like technology?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's a virtuous cycle. Even in that example, well, it took, you know, however many years, you know, 10, 12 years for the models to be able to now like just generate an app for you, right? Because we've learned, we've had these patterns and encoded those in the models. Well, maybe that shrinks down to either months or weeks before the tools are able to then generate it. So I do think that there is a big virtuous cycle there, but I still think there will be some, you know, even if it's weeks or months, there's going to be some need for a different skill set than the use of it. And that's true today, right? There's a different skill set for people that are really good at using Oracle than the people that build Oracle, right, as a database. And that's the distinction I'm kind of making.
Yeah, I think that's really good.
I think that makes sense. I also think that when I've seen a lot of really amazing creativity in this space is when an individual, particularly on the more sophisticated user side, uses both a sort of higher abstraction environment, like a low code platform for, you know, sort of that core infrastructure plumbing work, and uses an expressive environment. So it's kind of a broadening of the tool set and a blending of the two worlds. I've seen some just amazing work done in that case, because go really fast through the core environmental work using, you know, more of a declarative model oriented approach like we provide. And then when you hit that sort of boundary of the, you know, ambiguity where that then very bespoke, business specific, you know, competitive advantage lies, then go faster there. And I think that that's also an interesting dimension of this is we often say, oh, you know, here are the Tinker Toys, you know, the Duplo set for the people who don't really understand how to do the complicated things. And then we're going to hand the Erector set to the more sophisticated user. And I think that's also a mistake to make, is that I think you should allow access to the full tooling spectrum, both to your less well-trained, as well as your highly experienced, highly technical resources, and allow those blended environments to flourish.
I agree, but you had made a great point earlier. So you said when people come with a tool and it's not Turing complete, to run away. I agree with that one. I would also say in that environment, make sure that they have the idea, those tools have the idea of a sandbox or something to play around with, like SnapLogic has. A lot of times people don't have that kind of testing or sandbox environment that allows experimentation and promotion into production. That's just another thing to be wary of in tool vendors.
I want to pick back up on this idea of this well-trodden path real quick, and we talked a little bit about some of the benefits that are there. I think one of them is really this idea that optimizing towards the development, because a lot of what's happening now is we're taking the heavy list of the infrastructure and sort of abstracting that away, and that's the beauty of it. I'm curious, like, you know, there must be trade-offs from doing that. The one that immediately comes to mind, of course, is the idea you're relying more and more on other people's code and teams to do that correctly for you. Any thoughts about that?
I have a lot, but that, I'll let Jeremiah go first.
I think I'll tell you what. When you do evaluate a tooling environment or a service like this, I would highly encourage anybody looking into this to really understand the level of care, thought, and rigor that goes into the engineering of those tools. Because don't make no mistake, you are making a business decision to transfer risk. And you're transferring risk to the tooling provider of your choice. Now, that's true even if you have in-house developers using open source stack or something like that. And I think that is often poorly understood by business leaders. And I think you should look critically at that in both dimensions. Do I feel confident that we can carry the risk with the talent we have across the spectrum of technical complexity and business complexity? Or do we need a partner that's going to manage some of that risk, and we're going to put legal structure around that to support our strategy? And I think that's a very important part of the evaluation that is often overlooked, is where is the business risk moving? And if you are using a provider for core infrastructure components in your business, you are effectively transferring risk. And then, you know, that's where you really need to understand the referenceability of the platform. Are there other companies that have your similar problems, geography, scale, scope, velocity, et cetera, that are placing business critical workloads on that or not? Now, the same is true if you do it in-house. It's just a question of if you have a remedy, you know, beyond being angry at your employees. And that's an interesting challenge. But I see that entire risk analysis piece as very poorly understood and not well managed.
Yeah, I agree with that, especially around some of the tooling that you see. Like, does it have observability, visibility, the ability to be debug, you know, the ability to put data in specific geographies where we're required by law? All of those kind of things are really key, and a lot of immature platforms may not have them. And so it's an important thing to consider in evaluating any platform.
Well, we bring up the legal and its cousin regulatory risk here is going to be really interesting, because you think about how we're trying to regulate the economy through the Federal Reserve and all these different rules, things that we don't understand. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see how this continues to play out now within the technical world, to where, you know, that transfer of risk, you know, what happens when something goes wrong? You've got individuals that probably likely do not have the domain knowledge to be able to make those decisions, are going to arbitrate oftentimes in hindsight. And with the worst case scenario being ultimately being abdicated by 12 individuals who aren't smart enough to get off a jury. And so, you know, that's going to be really interesting how companies think through that and put that into the calculus of this. And so, but good or bad, that's nothing new. I mean, that's the way that things have always happened, whether it be from going from the farm to the industry, to the travel, to now computers and wherever else we go as society continues to evolve.
Things really good. I also will point out that, and this is especially when you add in the generative AI bits that we've talked a little bit about. And actually, before we go there, Let me ask you this. You guys are launching a new feature using some of this generative in pipeline building. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? And like, what have been the questions, the concerns? How have people been responding to that so far?
Yeah, that's really good. I would love to have Greg kind of take us through how we're approaching that technically. From a end user value or business perspective, we are absolutely focused on compressing the lines of communication and time between understanding a goal and a gap in the business and closing it. And so where we're really focused with the generative AI is sort of mentally think about the human process. Usually a person in the line of business is capable of writing down what they need. Often that starts in an email that then goes to a business analyst that may write a short form specification, et cetera, that then goes to a engineer who may build some sort of system or code in response, and then it translates back. So you typically have almost a little telephone game of multiple people talking to other people before you sort of get this communication loop. We're trying to compress that down. Imagine if that initial business user's request could be the initial input for the technical user to then iterate. And debugging is part of the critical process. Iteration is part of the critical process. So how do you accelerate that delivery of the business outcome through, creating a integration or automation pipeline? But, hand it over to Greg to talk about how we're actually doing that within the system, because there's a lot that goes on in terms of engineering the prompts and the chain of technology associated with that go from, please build a pipeline to connect my marketing system to my Salesforce system, and the actual code being generated.
Yeah, I'm happy to speak a little to that. It's been this space and our inclusion of this technology into the platform has been a whirlwind, and quite honestly, very exciting, just and fun to see what we can do. Like Jeremiah said, basically reducing the time it takes to go from, user expressing an intent of some sort of data integration or data transformation task to achieving that in our, visual pipeline representation. And the original prototype, although we've got a few other things that we're developing behind the scenes, used ChatGPT. We did prompt engineering to basically, in a prompt, give it enough information to teach it about what a Snap Logic pipeline is. We have our own sort of internal proprietary format, and it's not a conventional programming language, which ChatGPT and others have been trained on. So we had to give it some context so it could, do the reasoning and do the configuration. We were able to do that quite effectively and give in a particular range of domains and connectivity connectors and that sort of thing. We can generate a correct shape of a pipeline with different components that can be partially configured. Obviously our goal is to get it to be, 100% configured and working. We're not, not quite there yet, but it's pretty amazing. And, I've been working on this a long time to synthesize from intent. And so this breakthrough of the intention and the transfer model and the context is pretty amazing. I will add one thing that's really important to us, of course, is respecting our customer agreements around data privacy. And we are working towards an approach which allows us to both leverage the large language model technology and also leverage what customers have built and continue to build to be able to generate even more accurate pipelines. And there's a couple of ways we're approaching this, right? By the way, the whole space is emerging. Microsoft Azure's version of OpenAI is trying to give assurances around their data privacy model, and then we could treat them as a third party just like and those APIs just like we do, other services that we disclose to our customers. But probably the safest thing to do, and that we're also investing in, is working with our own large language models. I think we're going to approach at a point where there's going to be a new large language model at a rate that's faster than the creation of new JavaScript frameworks. If you go on Hugging Face, you'll see these new models and variations of models are appearing quite rapidly. But that's where we're headed on the data privacy side.
I think JavaScript frameworks are up to about 1 an hour now.
Sounds terrifying. And it sort of goes into my next question, which is, that's all, by the way, congratulations. Really cool what I've seen from your guys' stuff so far. And I'm certain that you're doing a lot more behind the scenes still. But this is all obviously super amazing and really cool. But it is fundamentally a different way of working, right? Like you just talked about the governance issues, the privacy issues, who's doing what, how does it, there's no longer a data person in the loop. If a marketer could just say, hey, I want a dashboard that shows me churn of users over the past 6 months, and it just automatically happens.
Well, it's interesting. It's really interesting that you say that, because I'd go back to the point Jason made, which I think is really important. If the usage of these models does not create some sort of knowable system that you can understand, manage, and tune, you're putting yourself into a pretty unknowable, unpredictable space. And the thought process we've taken is, how do we point different predictive models or generative models at the process of creating a pipeline that then a user can manage, edit, configure, et cetera. So we're very much full transparency, open, you know, no black boxes here kind of behavior. The system that creates the pipeline uses those kind of models, but the pipeline itself does not. The pipeline itself is very much very trustworthy, let's put it. And understandable in its behaviors. And I think that's going to be an interesting cleavage point on how these things are used. If it's business critical, I posit that for the time being, for the foreseeable future, we will want to understand at a very granular level how the system behaves. If it is not business critical and is supportive of a larger interaction that can be understood post hoc, say ad serving, that you can judge the performance of the system on the basis of an ongoing usage, then we'll probably be okay with a black box model. We are already today, let's face it, right? A lot of those models are already black box. So I think that will be an interesting shearing point in this whole discussion is, do I need to understand every single procedure call that is being undertaken in the, you know, execution of this function, this software, or am I content to understand the behavior of the system through its outputs? And I think that's going to be an interesting way to separate the domain here. But in our case, you know, we're very careful and thoughtful to understand exactly how the underlying work is being done. And we're using these predictive models to create a structure that is very understandable and knowable and explainable.
I mean, I 100% agree with that. And it's interesting on this first one, like we're not even really good at, you know, that, I mean, that was some of the ideas of, you know, some of, you know, the kind of the lambda based, you know, lambda calculus based systems where you could prove that a system was correct. Right. And we never really got to that point. And so this actually, I think, moves us even far away from that point. And so, you know, I do think that's a good way to kind of bifurcate whether something is, you know, can be judged by its outputs or not.
So as we get to the end of the podcast here today, I want to be a little bit more contemplative now and reflective of the conversation. I'm going to kick it over to you to kick it. I'm going to kick it over to you here first, Kevin, which is really back to this business decision of the transferring of risk and the optimization of internal developers, offloading some of the both the risk and the effort to some third party, to the point we just sat around, like, this is a different way of working, need a different org model to sort of have somebody who understands what's really being used, where it's being used, et cetera. What are your thoughts from today? How would you advise business leaders contemplating these higher abstraction layer tooling, especially in the generative space, but more broadly too? In other words, how do you set up the organization to take advantage of the superpower?
Well, I mean, My takeaway from today's discussion is down with STEM majors and rise of the liberal arts. But, I think it's going to, I don't know if anything truly changes. I mean, I think we keep on going back to the same themes of when I say truly changes, this is that organizations are always evolving. We're always spinning up new things. We're always changing. We're always reacting to that. I think this will just be the same element of that. You saw lots of rise of technologists and larger elements within the product space. As you've seen those converge, I think you'll continue to see the same skill sets and thinking that go into those. Maybe you'll have now more traditional business applications and you may serve your customers different. So, you know, what I think I love about as we grow and evolve as a society and the tools that allow us to be productive members of that society is that, you know, the constant is the change and the fact that we have to have a workforce and a product line or whatever it may be that can consistently evolve, and advantage will happen when people learn to harness that at a slightly faster pace. And I think it's, we've one other consistent theme from today's discussion has been ultimately there is inputs, there's competitive advantage in those inputs, how you deploy the tools around you, whether you're talking about a hammer or a computer or a spreadsheet or whiteout, they all work to help make you be faster in what you're trying to do. And I think that will be what will continue to happen. So a long non-answer to your question.
I like it. Jason, same question over to you, and I'll give you the added benefit of a different prompt slightly. I'm going to do a little prompt engineering myself on humans and see what the response is. So same question to you, but really I want to add the context that, you know, these tools are really meant to make developers faster and to empower business users to start solving some of their more well-understood problems, certainly. Does that mean that the gating fundamentally shifts the organizational dynamics of what are you blocked by IT for? Does this ultimately solve your shadow IT problem that CIOs have been struggling with for a long time, or is this just add to it?
Well, I think in the short term, it can certainly add to it. I don't really know, I guess, is the short answer. I do think there is a lot of potential to remove a lot of the bottlenecks for, you know, so much of what we do is just repetitive nonsense, you know, to use.
I think it's interesting you prompt with shadow IT, because I mean, I don't, you know, I've spent a generation trying to work with our customers on that. But to me, I mean, I don't know if there is, what is shadow IT anymore? I mean, I think that almost every function within a corporation is using IT for different elements of that. So it could be around governance and all those different components. And you have other elements like spend authority that get you in the way now today. But yeah, I think what's going to be really interesting is just continuing to enable people with the right tools, and how do you avoid different functions in your organization doing the same thing. I mean, that's what I think shadow IT today means to me. And so trying to make sure that we're being efficient with our tools and our time.
Is your question about shadow IT, or is it about making people more productive?
Both. I mean, I, the heart of the question was exactly what you just alluded to, or you said specifically, I guess. And also just this concept that if you could, again, abstract away a lot of the complexity of setting up these environments, centralize the decisions that have to be made, that empowers other people to use the core systems. Because again, my core belief is shadow IT, to your point, exists because people are trying to solve a problem. They can't because the environment in which they're supposed to solve it is too complex or too slow or too rigid. Therefore, they go spin up their own thing over here. It seems that these abstraction, higher level abstraction toolings ultimately address that and both centralize and simplify.
I don't know that they do address the shadow IT problem, because I don't know that the shadow IT problem exists because, well, this part of the organization is too slow or is too rigid, and I just want to go do what I want to go do, and this helps me go do it faster. In a lot of cases, the shadow IT organization exists because they want to do something they're not allowed to do. And you know, there's rules and governance and rigor that we put in place for some reason, you know, some business risk reason, and I want to go around that. And so the question is, well, is that a technology problem that it's not fast enough, or is that a problem of people don't want to follow the rules?
Or the rules aren't keeping up fast enough, which I think is more... I mean, if you believe in the good intent of people, which is a risk of doing that, you know, I think oftentimes the reason why people want to move faster is simply because the pace of change is moving faster than what our regulatory and internal and external environment are allowing us to do.
Right, but I 100% agree. It's not a technology tooling problem, right? And so, okay, the internal and external regulatory environments can't keep up with our really slow tooling today. Let's make that tooling a lot faster. Is not going to solve the problem. It's going to make the problem worse, I guess, is what my thoughts. You know, short term, it'll make the problem a lot worse.
All right. Fair enough. Jeremiah, over to you. How do you set up the organization to take advantage of this new superpower? And where have you seen some of your clients be really successful in doing this?
I think what we're seeing is in many ways the technology world maturing to the point at which other behaviors in the business world can be applied to it. I'd almost posit that we're ready for a technical delegation of authority. In the purchasing world, in the business world, you have a very you know, well thought through legal, business, financial approach to this called delegation of authority. Which groups have authority to bring on new suppliers, to invest in research and development, to invest in business partnerships? I think you have a similar approach here, but what comes with that is accountability. And if you have the authority delegated to you, you also own the accountability for delivery against that. And I think that's what we're seeing more and more is the core technology team becomes an enabling function whose primary job in life is actually integration and automation of individual line of business SaaS solutions more and more. And the accountability is become shared, it becomes distributed, but you have to keep it clear. And so we have, for example, a multinational pharmaceutical company that operates on this model. And the vast majority of the integration pipelines are authored by business technologists embedded in the business, but the business has chosen to invest in that talent and headcount because they can move autonomously in parallel with one another. And then the core technology team really focuses on development of best practices, governance, monitoring, observability, and then looking at things like data loss prevention and risk management around the usage of the system. So I think that's where we're headed, is that the notion that we can somehow create a, you know, a cathedral around the technology and have it centralized is, I think we should all declare defeat on that one and instead move to a model where we can create this federated accountability and mutual support between people who are closest to the business problem and people who are most expert at the technology.
Yeah, super interesting. Greg, over to you. Why don't computer engineers have certifications like all other engineering professions? No, seriously, it's a super fascinating question. But I guess the real question to you, you can answer that one if you want, but the real question to you is more about, as a leader in a business, given that everything is changing so quickly, given that talent is so scarce in particular, like how do you help level up your own internal people to take advantage of these kinds of abstraction layers, either from a technical or from a process or people standpoint, wherever you want to go?
Yeah, I mean, we not only help our customers in their technology space and problems, but you know, we're a technical organization and we also need to adapt and to level up, as you say, to embrace these. I definitely think even before the generative AI stuff, right, flexibility and exploration and you know, call it 20% time, call it what you will in terms of being able to experiment and move rapidly. I do think the pace appears to be changing in terms of how quickly folks who weren't as technical or even for technical people, how it's changing what they focus on. To go back to your question, it might even allow sort of for quicker experimentation or zeroing in on what's going to work from a business standpoint. But, you know, as we discussed in this podcast, there's still a lot of open questions that remain to be answered. But you could argue there was a lot of open questions when the general, you know, browser was introduced too, and we evolved. So, I mean, it's a movie that's unfolding before our eyes. And just like I tell my students that when I log on the internet, I'm just as amazed as I was 25 years ago, right? And I think this is like a special moment in time that we all get to experience and see how it progresses. That, you know, that we're not near the end of this movie. We're just the beginning, kind of Jeremiah alluded to in the beginning. So I'd say, yeah, to allocate at least some resources to experimenting in this space. When I say this space, I mean generative AI and some of the tooling that has adopted this, because it's significant. I mean, it's going to change the pace of business.
Well, I love that. And Jeremiah, Greg, again, thank you both so much for joining us today. I think you had some really insightful elements to add, and I certainly love hearing both of your perspectives all the time. For those listeners who want to learn more about SnapLogic or some of the cool things you guys are working on, feel free to check out their podcast, Automating the Enterprise. And if you want to see that example of where they're actually integrating ChatGPT with pipeline building. So again, just imagine a world where you don't build a pipeline, you can just ask for it. Check out the Snap Labs. You guys have that in private beta now, is that right?
That's correct. SnapGPT, we have a sign-up list in private beta, and we are starting a regular open lab that we're calling Snap Labs Corner, where we're going to be really bringing people in on the inside as we're exploring the use of this generative technology and trying to really demystify and show how we're applying this and have a conversation, you know, with our community. And so we would certainly invite people to check that out. I'll send you over the link. You can throw it in the show notes of people that want to get on the inside of applying, you know, generative artificial intelligence.
I love that. Thank you both. And for those of you who'd like to learn more, feel free to visit the insights page at Codara.com. Again, thank you, Jason. Thank you, Kevin. Thank both of you on our SnapLogic side. This was amazing. I appreciate it. Thanks for listening. I hope you join us again.